Hi everyone. Good evening and thank you for joining us at the Lowy Institute tonight. My name is Kelsey Munro and I'm a research fellow here. I'd like to start by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which we're meeting, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and pay respect to their elders past and present. So tonight we're here to discuss censorship, China's unique version of the internet, and its implications for the rest of us. So do you remember when the internet was going to set everyone free? Early internet advocates, techno-libertarians mostly, believed the internet would be a place without borders, erasing the legal jurisdictions of the physical world. Many people believed the internet would unleash free speech and democratic forces in some of the world's most closed societies. And the US President Bill Clinton said 19 years ago in his famously homespun vernacular that cracking down on the internet was like trying to nail Jell-O to a wall. Good luck, he said. The flip side of near-perfect surveillance and censorship and an end to privacy and freedom didn't feature much in those early visions. But many argue that contemporary China is coming close to that reality. It's an appropriate time to be discussing this topic with the Chinese censors in overdrive ahead of the highly sensitive 30th anniversary next week of the 1989 student protests and the military crackdown, which killed hundreds of protesters. Due to the success of China's censorship regime in the years since, younger generations of Chinese remain, for the most part, completely unaware of the events of June 1989. China has really successfully shaped an alternative version of the internet within its own borders, asserting what it has come to call its cyber sovereignty. Sensitive topics are quashed, many foreign news sources are blocked. Protected from international competitors, domestic companies willing to play by the Communist Party's rules have grown to dominate China's digital landscape. In place of Google, Facebook, Apple, Amazon, eBay, it's Baidu, Tencent, Alibaba, Xiaomi, and Huawei. So it's a rich, varied, and pretty efficient digital ecosystem for Chinese consumers, but it coexists with an increasing reality of total internet control by a sort of state industrial complex that seeks to preempt subversive sentiment before it can take root. And we're also in a time when democracies around the world are grappling with the many downsides of a free and open internet, such as hate speech and extremist material, and it's not hard to see how the Chinese government's iron control over the internet might be appealing to other governments, and not only the authoritarians. So to discuss these issues and their implications, I'm really pleased to introduce our panel tonight. In the middle here, James Griffiths is a senior journalist at CNN International based in Hong Kong. He's reported from China, South Korea and Australia. He's also worked at the South China Morning Post, where he covered the 2014 umbrella movement in Hong Kong. And he's the author of a really interesting new book called The Great Firewall of China, How to Build and Control an Alternative Version of the Internet. Vicky Xu covers the intersection of Australian and Chinese politics from Sydney for the New York Times, as well as reporting on business, education and religion in Australia's immigrant communities. She was previously producer at the ABC and in China trained as a newsreader for state media. She's also, in her spare time, a stand-up comedian, which is a particularly unique skill set, if ever I've heard one. And my colleague Natasha Kassam is a research fellow here at the Lowy Institute, where she leads the Diplomacy and Public Opinion Program and directs the annual Lowy Institute poll, which is coming out next month. She was previously an Australian diplomat based in Beijing for many years, where she covered domestic politics and human rights, and she also worked on the drafting of Australia's 2017 Foreign Policy White Paper. So welcome to you all, and thank you for being here. What I'm hoping to try and cover tonight is what we're talking about with the Great Firewall, how it works, why the Chinese state is so invested in it, and what implications it has for the rest of the world. So, James, if I can start with you, what is the Great Firewall, and how in lay terms does it work?
Yeah, so the Great Firewall, this is a term coined by Wired magazine, it refers to a lot of different intersecting systems and tools, but you can kind of break it down into two levels. So you have the Great Firewall as it exists at the international level, and that's what kind of most people think of when they think of censorship in China. That's the technology that exists as the as queries are kind of sent from within China, within the Chinese internet, and they go out to the international internet, and they're trying to reach servers in the US or reach servers elsewhere in the world, and that's what's blocking things like trying to get access onto Twitter or trying to go on Facebook in China. That is kind of obviously very important and does have an effect on how people interact with the internet in China, but is perhaps not really what most people deal with in their day-to-day life when we're talking about censorship. The kind of really important part of the Great Firewall from a Chinese perspective is how it exists at the national level. And that's what exists within Chinese internet companies. And so you have, you know, surveillance built into a lot of, you know, your ISP. And then if you go to various internet companies like Weibo or WeChat, they employ thousands of human sensors. They use artificial intelligence to monitor what people are saying, what people are posting, how discussions are developing, when things need to be censored. And there are kind of a handful of obvious topics that I'm sure everyone in this room can think of, which are kind of forbidden on the Chinese internet. And then there's also a kind of massive gray area, which these companies are kind of left to judge for themselves what should be censored and what the government wouldn't want people to talk about. And that really benefits the government, because not only are they not paying for these companies, you know, the companies are kind of providing the service pro bono, as it were, to the government, because it's a kind of gray area and you have people making decisions on the fly, it tends to trend towards kind of more control and more censorship, because few companies are willing to take a risk that, you know, we should have blocked something and we didn't.
So keep them guessing. Can you give us a sort of short history of how it came about, the sort of key turning points in how China's internet has really diverged from the global internet?
Yeah, so I mean, the internet came to China relatively late in terms of kind of major economies. In September 1987 is the kind of first email that was sent from China. And, you know, obviously then 2 years later, you have the Tiananmen movement, and, you know, the internet was kind of spreading out, but was a very much limited to university campuses. There were, you know, probably, you know, a couple dozen people around the country who actually had access. But Tiananmen really kind of woke up a lot of people to the potential of the internet for social movements, and not only dissidents and activists on the square, but also the authorities, who kind of recognized that, you know, had this massive communications platform been available in the country, this could have been a threat. And you see the kind of early bricks of the Great Firewall being laid from that point forwards. And in the beginning, it was pretty rudimentary. There were quite a lot of ways around it. You know, people used to kind of spam emails into China to get democracy newsletters into the country. You could use proxy servers and get past the firewall. But then as it kind of improved, you also had this domestic internet kind of technology sphere developing. And, you know, this was kind of aided by, you know, to be charitable, we might say inadvertent protectionism of the firewall. To be cynical, you might say deliberate protectionism of the firewall really benefited these domestic companies like Weibo, like WeChat, Baidu, and things like that. And there is a kind of real rush of excitement when these companies first appeared, especially Weibo, which in the early days, you know, especially around kind of 2008, 2009, was really exciting, was the kind of seen as something that could have a genuine social change, and did to a certain degree, especially air pollution is a major issue that Weibo kind of drove the conversation on and really influenced government policy. But as that started to have influence, the government also then reined it in. And there's always been this kind of cycle that as things, you know, bubble up in, off, you know, present any kind of threat, the government cracks down upon them and reins them in. And it's so far has shown itself more than capable of dealing with anything that threatens the firewall.
Vicky, you grew up in China, behind the Great Firewall, as it were. What does the internet look like to an average person in China? Are they aware of the censorship, and do they even care?
Right. To say what an average Chinese person looks like would be quite hard, because there are a lot of people and not a lot of studies available. But my parents were here for a very short vacation, and today I was having a chat with my dad about this, and I said, do you remember the days when we had Google? That was around 2009, 2010. And it really took him a few seconds, and he was like, huh, that was a long time ago. So, I mean, for an average person, now, these days, we have an entire alternative version of internet. You know, instead of Facebook, we have WeChat. And instead of, you know, Reddit, we have Zhihu. You know, we have TikTok. We have a lot of fun stuff. And last night, my dad was online doing this app, Earning Points. This app is called Study the Strong Nation. So it's basically an app where you can earn points for studying Xi Jinping's thoughts and, you know, brush up on your socialist values. It is fun to do that, too, for some people. So that's what it looks like. And do they run into censorship is a different issue. So for journalists, for Chinese journalists, they have to dance. You know, for people who want to write about sensitive issues, when I say sensitive, that includes the Me Too movement, that includes the pollution problems. and they have to sort of dance around the censorship. But for an average person, when they run into censorship, it could be, well, last year there was a ban on Weibo of LGBT content. So that could be a novel that brought, you know, that has main characters who are homosexual, or, you know, that's when you run into censorship, you feel it, if that makes sense. And the question of do they care, if it affects your social life, if it affects your life, right? So, an example would be 2016, I covered this flood in China. It's a natural disaster, but the state does not want any media coverage on it, except for, you know, the heroic efforts the Chinese government had, you know, how they were trying to rescue people and help them to survive this major disaster. And there were villagers who were complaining about the lack of responses and the lack of rescue efforts. And when you're complaining about that, when you're on social media, you get censored. And that's when people feel the pain. But on a daily basis, my sense is most people are pretty content with the alternative system we have, which also produced an alternative value system. Because, you know, the Chinese internet, if we have, you can see a lot of Islamophobic comments. And I'm not seeing, you know, Weibo taking a, really making an effort to, how do you say, to clean them out. You don't see people actively reporting them. So they exist, and there are a lot of them. And yeah, I hope that answers the question.
Yeah. Yeah, it was allowed to stay up on Weibo and Chinese social media for a lot longer
than on Facebook or Twitter. Yes.
Yeah, interesting. So I was going to ask you, Natasha, what sort of things are censored in China? Maybe some particular examples, and also how activists and people troubled by this work to get around it.
And so I think that this is something that the conventional wisdom was that the things that are censored are calls to collective action, challenges to the CCP. And now that there's a little bit more data, more people are kind of scraping the internet to figure out what is being censored. That's definitely an issue, but also, potentially equally as important is the audience that you're able to reach. And so you'll see people with a lot of followers are more likely to be censored than people without. You'll see that people who are using WeChat, a messaging app that's a lot like WhatsApp, if you're having a one-to-one conversation, you're less likely to be censored than if you are having a conversation with a group, like a WhatsApp group, but on WeChat, which can have up to 500 members. And so that sphere is, it's almost considered semi-public, and it's much more likely to be subject to this kind of censorship. So, and as people have said, there are the issues you would expect to be censored on human rights issues or perhaps government failings of some kind. But the way in which activists get around this, I think, depends on what they want to achieve. So if they're trying to organize, I think most of them, in my experience, will move to apps that are not provided by the Chinese government. They'll move to things you might have heard of, like Telegram or Signal. In the case of the Umbrella Movement in Hong Kong, they were using something called FireDoor, which is an app that connects people through Bluetooth rather than the internet, the idea being that maybe they wouldn't be able to be monitored or shut down as easily. And so if you're close to people, people in China are doing that as well. At protests, they're trying to use apps that are, they think, not subject to the same level of censorship. But that's to organize. If activists want to get their message out there, it is much more challenging in this kind of an environment. So what you see is people moving to homonyms. So in China, Mandarin is, I think, quite a good language for using homonyms, where you can sound like what you're trying to say, but you don't have to use the exact words. And some examples might be they're not able to speak about the Me Too movement that Vicky mentioned, and so they'll use Me Too, which means rice bunny, and it sounds like Me Too, but they're just posting rice bunny, and that is less likely to be censored at first. But the system is very sophisticated, and it catches up very quickly. I think similarly, you'll see, you know, the anniversary of Tiananmen is coming up, and people refer to it because they can't say the 4th of June. They'll say, I think it's May 35th. But again, this works for a few days, and the sensors do catch up, whether it's the actual individuals who are running the censorship machine or if it is AI figuring it out. Similarly, people will use photographs because they feel like that the keywords will not be as, if the system is detecting keywords, use a photograph. But again, the system does catch up with that quite quickly.
Sorry, can I just jump in? Vicky actually told me a really entertaining anecdote about censorship of a photograph. Can you tell us that story?
Yes, this was a couple of years ago. It was also the anniversary of 1989 Tiananmen Square massacre. And at the time, I think this was 2016, at the time, people realized that the emoji of a candle emoji was banned on Weibo because, you know, the emoji means rest in peace, and that's banned. So I was just being a bit facetious, and I took a photo of the candle on my dinner table, and I posted it on my Weibo account, and the next day my account was gone. Don't have a lot of followers, it's okay. It is okay.
But I think that's an illustration of, I mean, that's the extraordinary attention to detail in the censorship apparatus, the sort of mass mobilization to get seemingly harmless content. I mean, how responsive is the system, James?
Yeah, I mean, it's very, very responsive, I mean, especially around stuff as sensitive as Tiananmen. But this is a good example. I mean, you kind of touched on it in your introduction of how kind of technological development really benefits the authorities and benefits the censors. You know, there was always this idea, especially in the early days, that as these technologies improved, it would kind of naturally help free speech and help, you know, the forces of democracy and liberalism. But, you know, if anything, it's actually more beneficial for the people on the other side because, you know, as a, you know, in the early days, people used to be able to switch to using homonyms or to using photographs. There was a big thing. And then recently, a couple of months ago, there was a big thing of having a kind of photo of text that you then distorted enough that you as a human being could read it, but in theory, an AI couldn't read it. You know, a bit like kind of Google Capture things that we always have to put in when you're doing your password. And the technology catches up very quickly and actually probably is, you know, outracing, you know, human ingenuity when it comes to doing these things. And it is getting more and more effective at catching the ways of getting around it, especially on sensitive topics. And it's, you know, not to be too pessimistic and depressing, but it's, you know, it's one of those things where you kind of, you know, it's an arms race where you have the second largest economy in the world on one side and a bunch of, you know, largely student activists on the other, and it's quite easy to see who's going to win.
Tash, we've talked a bit about what and how. Why does the Chinese government do this?
I think that's a really important question because so often people say the CCP just want to control everything, but it's not control for the sake of control. I think, you know, the ultimate goal is regime survival. We might not know a lot about what Chinese leaders are thinking, but we know that they study the collapse of the Soviet Union. We know they read Alexis de Tocqueville about the French Revolution. We know that, you know, the 2017 National Security Law essentially defines security as, you know, the absence of threat to the party's ability to govern. It's quite different to how we might consider security. And so I think the challenge for China's leadership is to maintain what it considers the benefits of the internet to be, which are, you know, about commerce, innovation, understanding public opinion, but without allowing technological advancement to threaten their role or accelerate political change in a way that threatens their role. And so I think there are four key things there that in kind of the Great Firewall is, I think, multi-purpose in how it serves these goals. So we've already talked a lot about how they can eliminate material that they think will lead to dissent and lead to collective action against them. They can insulate. We also talked about their tech giants from foreign competition to make them stronger. And, you know, you already have the former cybersecurity czar said something like, you know, would we have Baidu if we had had Google? Like, they accept that this has been a big part of the system. And I think now if you look at the 20 largest tech companies in the world by market share, 9 of them are Chinese. So there's that. So I think then that they can shape public opinion by promoting their messages. And I think China particularly does I think a lot of people call it flooding, where they put out so much more information that any kind of small things that don't get picked up by the censors will be drowned out by all of the sponsored official propaganda that's out there. And then finally, I think the fourth way in which the firewall serves this outcome is they can tap into sentiments and they can respond more effectively. So by being able to monitor the internet in the way that they do and monitor public opinion in the way that they do, the center or Beijing is able to understand what is going on in this huge country. The age-old problem in China is that Beijing can't get local governments to do what it wants necessarily, and this leads to corruption drives. This leads to, the center being furious when a local water source is polluted or tainted baby formula is being sold to Chinese people, because to their mind, their legitimacy rests on these people being satisfied enough to not question their authority. And so monitoring the internet gives them insight and they can be quite responsive in that sense. And so for me, I think those are the key reasons why they're doing this.
James, did you have anything to add there?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I absolutely agree that, you know, the kind of maintaining stability and maintaining one-party rule is the kind of number one, probably the driving force of most political activity in China, that, you know, because you can't continue to govern, you know, in the way that democratic governments are always focused on the next election, and the Chinese government is always focused on maintaining control and making sure that it can remain in power in perpetuity. And I think that kind of translates into the sphere of censorship in quite interesting ways, in that you'll see stuff which isn't necessarily, you know, obviously political and certainly wouldn't be considered kind of, you know, threatening the government in a democratic society. But, you know, Vicky mentioned that the Me Too movement, and there was a lot of censorship of that. And that was because people were organizing offline and they were kind of spreading solidarity with other groups. And you saw kind of a degree of collective action, even though it was around stuff that really shouldn't be seen as a threat to the Communist Party. It was, you know, I think one of the original campaigns was stopping sexual harassment on public transport. You know, this isn't a thing that tends to bring down governments, but because this was growing as a group, and, you know, you were seeing more and more women and men joining it, it was seen as a threat and it was heavily censored. And so the kind of sensitivity to anything that could potentially, you know, even 10, 20 years down the line, bubble up into something which then threatens one-party rule, that is so sensitive that they try and kill it right at birth.
Okay. So one of the unique aspects of this system is it has sort of extraterritorial effect. Vicky, how are the effects of China's censorship regime felt by Chinese overseas? Does it apply in some aspects,
right,
overseas?
It does. The censorship definitely does affect people who live overseas, and that doesn't just include Chinese Australians or like ethnic Chinese people. The sort of model of censorship has also been sort of exported into countries like Tanzania. So, for example, in 2015, Tanzania passed these like series of laws and regulations that really like mirrors the censorship laws and regulations in China. And that is something that is potentially quite alarming. And also there are like countries that sort of have like shared partnerships with China, such as like Turkey or Sudan or Ethiopia, that also have like really strong and strict censorship laws in place. And in terms of Chinese, ethnic Chinese people who speak Chinese, who use, you know, who use Chinese, who consumes Chinese media, WeChat is one of the main platforms, you know, where information is shared and news articles are being shared. And, well, for example, in Australia, both the ABC and SBS and even the New York Times, we have a channel, we have a site on WeChat. But this WeChat channel, on this WeChat channel, we can't just post anything. So for the ABC, it becomes ABC Live, where we share lifestyle articles of, you know, from ABC. And on SBS, I think it's basically the same thing. For the New York Times, it becomes New York Times educational channel, because the hard news articles that we produce every day can absolutely not exist on WeChat, which means it's not about media outlets self-censoring. It's about if you want to deliver any of your content to your readers who speak Chinese, this is how you're going to survive.
So the consequences are if you hit one of those red lines, you would lose that channel.
You could lose your article, you could lose your channel. It really depends on how strong, when, you know, yeah. How much you want to challenge the lines.
How much of a fight you want to take up to it. So what about, I was under the impression there is some sort of separate regime that applies to WeChat accounts registered overseas and those within China. Are there different rules?
I think, this is just something I've noticed when I spent time on WeChat. Sometimes I would post something and my friends who have registered their WeChat account with an overseas phone number, they can see the stuff that I post. But those who are in China or have registered their WeChat account with a Chinese number, they cannot see that. But I'm not too sure about the very complicated regulations behind that.
There is a somewhat of a divide between kind of Weixin, which is the Chinese version, and WeChat, which is the international version. But it's more of a kind of degree of tolerance on the international version is perhaps higher, but there definitely is monitoring and censorship which occurs. It's been Citizen Lab in Toronto have done a lot of work looking into kind of especially how WeChat kind of censors and monitors international users. And Tencent kind of has pushed back against some of this, but it has been shown that they are paying attention and they are concerned about how their platform is used, even if it's just two people talking to each other in Canada.
Mm. So, I mean, that surely raises sort of sovereignty issues for Australia and other Western countries. What can democracies do about that, if anything?
Who are you aiming at? You can take the difficult question.
I think it's a really difficult question, and one thing that they can do is to try to ensure that your democracy and your system is sufficiently resilient to these sorts of issues. But I do think it's important to remember that, you know, yes, there are differences between overseas and domestic WeChat usage and censorship. But for example, in Australia, you've got, I think it's a recent survey showed that more than 60% of Mandarin-speaking Australians use WeChat as their sole news source, right? So they're using what we know to be a censored platform as their sole news source. The same people were asked about how regularly they read the ABC and the Sydney Morning Herald. 20% said that they regularly used that. So when you know that a significant proportion of the Australian population are relying on a source like WeChat for their news, I mean, on the one hand, you can understand why in a recent federal election you have a significant number of candidates who are using WeChat to engage with those Chinese-speaking populations. But on the flip side, you worry about how honest are they being, how careful are they being to not have either their articles deleted or their accounts deleted. I think it was a number of years ago during the Umbrella Movement in Hong Kong, a Canadian member of parliament posted a message of solidarity on WeChat with people who were protesting in Hong Kong, and it was deleted. And so, you know, this is a part of our election campaign. People are potentially not getting the full story from their members of parliament or from candidates for election who are using this platform. And so, I mean, we can try to ensure that there are more sources available. We, you know, Australia has taken a lot of steps about more direct foreign interference in Australian political processes, but I think this is an awareness-raising issue when it comes to democracies like ours.
And one thing I would add on that is also that, you know, it's important that these kind of conversations don't always happen in a kind of negative way and cracking down on, you know, a lot of times kind of foreign interference and foreign apps operating in countries, especially Chinese ones or Russian ones, tend to be framed in, you know, in a kind of suspicious way, which then can you know, have knock-on effects for how the community is perceived and stuff. But really, it should also be seen in a kind of improving standards on that platform. The government could intervene not to kind of crack down on the platform, but to hold them to a higher standard and say, if you want to operate in this market, you need to conform to certain standards of free speech and not censor users. And unfortunately, a lot of times when we've seen governments willing to kind of intervene in internet regulation, you know, after decades of taking a really hands-off approach, they intervene in a very kind of censorious and controlling way, but there is a way that they could be intervening to protect us as users, both in terms of privacy, but also in terms of free speech. You know, there's no reason that WeChat in Australia should be the same as WeChat in China. Tencent may be very happy for it to be the same, But, you know, there is a room for the government to perhaps say this isn't correct for our own country.
Are there any Western countries that have tried that you're aware of? Sort of breaking down the double standards of regulation on Facebook versus Tencent?
Not that I'm aware of. Mm. And you know, when this stuff does tend to come up, it is nearly always framed in terms of, you know, alleged Chinese influence, or, you know, it's framed in a very hostile way and not in a kind of improving standards way.
I think that's a really important point when you think about, you know, what Vicky was saying about Chinese models being taken to places like Tanzania, and you can see that across Africa, parts of South America. You know, the way that we often talk about this is the idea of China exporting its model and it kind of almost being imposed on these developing countries. But actually, I think we should understand that for a lot of countries, not just developing countries, this model is appealing, right? I mean, countries like Australia, like the United States, are all dealing with how to monitor content that we're not happy with. Australia's recently passed a law on this. And, you know, I think recently Facebook and YouTube said they were going to hire thousands of more staff to monitor their platforms, which sounds a lot like a Chinese model in some ways. So I think it's important to note that there is an appeal in this for other countries. It's not something that is, you know, Chinese interference being exported. I mean, maybe that is it in part, but also countries are struggling with this. Mm-hmm. And the idea of a more controlled model is appealing to a lot of places.
The governments, anyway.
Yes, sorry. Good clarification.
James, in your book, you document some of the international efforts China's made to sort of shift internet's governance into its cyber sovereignty model. What does that look like, and have they had any success?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, China is, you know, investing massively in exporting the firewall, both at a kind of technological level through Chinese companies helping build out infrastructure and, you know, provide surveillance tools, but then also in helping other countries shape their laws and shape the kind of policies around the internet. And then that feeds back into efforts by Beijing at the kind of UN level, at the International Telecommunications Union, and other kind of international bodies which set a lot of the regulation and rules about the internet, which most of us kind of are completely unaware of and don't interact with in our daily lives, but do exist and do affect how companies behave online. And, you know, they've tended to be very US influenced just because of the nature of how the internet developed. But China is having more and more of an influence, and it has a lot of support, you know, from Russia, from a lot of Middle Eastern countries, and then increasingly from allies in Asia and Africa, that, you know, about kind of changing these international regulations to support this idea of absolute cyber sovereignty, of, you know, kind of endorsing, you know, government-led censorship of the internet from a kind of international UN level. And you can see that that is partly about shoring up the firewall against any kind of external threat. And then also, I think, about setting the stage for the future development of the internet as the internet does become more decentralized, and as the kind of traditional broadband, you know, wires model of, you know, cables that, you know, kind of are easier to censor. And as we move towards a kind of distant future of a kind of decentralized mesh internet and things like that, that if you make censorship and cyber sovereignty, you know, make it a sovereignty issue, make this an international relations issue, your ability to exercise control and to prevent people from interfering is much greater.
Okay. Now, look, I'm going to open it up to questions from the floor after this. One more. And I will, we'll take a couple at once. We'll try and get through as many as we can. And please, no speeches, just questions. And just finally, Tash, you touched on some of this, but open societies are really grappling with the darker side of the internet. Should we be taking lessons from Beijing? They probably don't have the kind of extremist content problem that Western societies might have now.
You know, people are definitely taking lessons from China. You know, you can find a whole host of people, you know, from kind of Lindsey Graham to Bono, who have praised the Great Firewall when they're trying to make arguments about the internet. You know, the instinct to surveil and control, I think, is pretty strong in any government, no matter kind of what its color. But the danger is that we see this kind of, you know, knee-jerk legislation that's passed in the event of, in, you know, in the wake of tragedies, in the wake of things like Christchurch, you know, I think unfortunately the Australian example is perhaps the leading one at the moment, that, you know, legislation that's rushed through has a lot of ramifications for free speech, for people's privacy online, for people's ability to kind of organize and interact online, that isn't given the proper scrutiny, both at a kind of political level, then also at a kind of public level. You know, we don't tend to debate internet legislation. It's not a thing that kind of comes up unless there is some horrible tragedy and, you know, we're worried about extremist content. So, you know, I think this is something that people need to pay more attention to, because it's something that touches, you know, every part of our lives and does affect how we do nearly everything. And if this is legislated and this is controlled in a negative way and in a way that results in kind of more power for a security state and more power for our governments to surveil us, that's potentially a dangerous road to go down.
I would also just add that it is in China's interest for people to think that they're very effective and that it's working very well. And in many ways it is, but in some ways it isn't. For example, you know, China will boast about how successful its facial recognition systems are. And it is in its interest to do that. It is trying to sell those models overseas. But in China, there's not a lot of talk about failure. Talk about failure is often censored. I think it was in the United Kingdom, the police tried to use a similar system and had a 98% fail rate in terms of recognizing crime.
Solid.
I would say that China is, in terms of, for example, extremist content, very good at playing whack-a-mole. But that isn't necessarily mean it's fixing the problem that all of these societies are grappling with. And so it is in its interests for it to advertise that it works incredibly well for reasons that we've discussed, but I'm not convinced it's working as well as that.
Okay. Well, thanks. Sorry, Vicky. Sorry.
Yeah. I would also add that it's also important to know, you know, like how we define extremism anyway. Because, for example, I've been doing a lot of reporting on the Uyghur community in Australia, and in this process, we have interviewed a couple of Chinese Han students here. And, when you talk to a Han student, well, I talked to a few of them when, there was a event on the Uyghur situation earlier this year at Sydney University. And the students, what they were saying, so, they went there sort of trying to figure out what this is because they couldn't really grapple, like, what is the crisis? What is happening? And to them, it almost sounded like a Western conspiracy theory, right? I was sitting behind these two students and I could saw them. They got on Baidu and then they Googled, they searched for 2018 Xinjiang GDP growth. So,
a marker of how much investment there's been in the camps?
Which is a marker of how Xinjiang is doing well. There's okay. No, right? And then I talked to them for a little bit and they're like, you know, this is why, you know, China's done a great job sort of rooting out extremism. So this is how China, this is, you know, how these people would define extremism. And this is how maybe the Chinese government defines extremism. But, you know, here in Australia, this whole discourse of East Turkestan or the self-determination of the Uyghur people is a discourse that can exist that is not defined as extremism. But if China can so successfully sort of exclude this discourse, sort of disclose this, the whole right of talking about self-determination, then, I mean, it comes back to, yeah, we should ask the question how we define extremism in the first place, you know, and
every government's going to have their own version
of extremism, exactly.
Yeah, okay. Well, look, thank you. I will open up to the floor now. Please wait, raise your hand, and if you'd like to ask a question and wait for a microphone. Yeah, down here.
Hi, I'm wondering whether you can expand a little bit more on some of the methods of censorship. So we talked a lot about content being taken down or accounts being deleted, but what about, you know, channeling bubbling resentment? So, you know, officially sanctioned venting. So, you know, whether it's a corrupt official or a government that goes off track or a development which collapses. Can you talk about how China uses those kinds of examples of allowing people to vent their frustration in issues to channel debate and use that as a censorship function?
Yeah, and this is a really interesting topic that there, you know, from the outside, often you can kind of see this discussion, and it can kind of seem that this isn't a very sensitive, isn't as sensitive as you know it's portrayed often, because people are criticizing ex government official who has like six Rolexes on his arm and you know in theory earns you know a tiny salary every month, or you know they're criticizing air pollution, or they're criticizing you know various other issues, and I think there is a degree to which those are that is tolerated. To a certain level, you know, there tends to be a certain ranking of official who can be complained about online, and you know, as people towards the top maybe can't be. And certainly, you know, once someone's entered the corruption process, you can kind of mouth off about them, and you're nice and safe. But if they're really secure and they're the big boss in your province or in your town, you maybe don't want to do so. But then, what's in a kind of more sinister way is that there is definitely an encouragement and a kind of allowance of discussion of nationalist issues. And so you see quite a lot that discussions that would never be allowed to get to this level on certain other topics, on issues of kind of Chinese sovereignty in the South China Sea, or you know things like issues of Taiwan independence or Hong Kong independence, that there will be a kind of encouragement of a lot of discussion which tends to trend in a government direction. You know, and probably we can assume that some of that is happening because anyone with a dissenting voice is being censored. But then it is also important to point out that there is a huge degree of, you know, domestic support for these issues anyway. You know, there are a lot of nationalists in any country. You know, China's no different. And kind of allowing that as a kind of release valve, it is, I think, should be quite concerning, because you can imagine that in the instance of kind of serious economic problems in China or other kind of, you know, government struggles, that the instinct to open that release valve towards nationalism and to get people, you know, focused on something else, to pivot that attention somewhere else, could be very strong and could, you know, quickly kind of bubble out of control. And then one last point on that would be that while this is definitely a release valve, there is still the same sensitivity about collective action. So in 2014 or 2015, when there was the UN ruling about the Philippines' rights to parts of the South China Sea, there were a lot of protests outside. I think KFC was targeted as a symbol of America, a couple of Filipino businesses, and I think the Filipino embassy was targeted. And that was tolerated for a while, and then they decided, actually, this is getting, you know, these protests are getting too big, this could spiral with us, because, you know, once people are out in the street and they're shouting, they can quickly start shouting about something else. And it got clamped down upon, and state media started saying, you know, people need to be more responsible, you shouldn't go to the streets, you know, rely on the government to represent our interests and stuff like that. So while there is this kind of release valve, the sensitivities about any kind of action outside of the party system are definitely still there.
And I think you can see quite a lot of evidence just like that of them kind of assessing it as it develops and trying to make decisions on what works and what doesn't. I think similarly, there was a quite famous documentary that came out called Under the Dome about air pollution, and you saw hundreds of millions of views piling up. And I remember being in Beijing and saying, when are they going to take this off the internet? You know, when they did it later than everybody expected, but it was, you know, they thought a useful pressure valve, as far as we can tell, for people to have a vent about the environment, for Li Keqiang to stand up and say, these are all the ways in which we hear you and we want to improve pollution. But then it got so popular that it became threatening and it came down. But, I mean, you can't unsee what you've seen. If 200 million people have seen a documentary, you know, taking it off the internet doesn't take that issue away. And so they're still able to say, we're responding in these particular ways, but we're going to stop that from being spread any further.
Thanks for your presentation. My name is Bill Bowman. Would you agree that the internet, that the issue is not so much that there is internet censorship or social media censorship, but the real issue is, what is there an absolute right of free speech? So most people would accept that you don't have a right to encourage terrorism or online indoctrination of major world religions in order to encourage people to do violent acts. There should be an official discouragement of fake news. So the issue is not really that there is censorship, but rather what to censor. Is that the real issue?
I take that as well.
Who wants to jump in there?
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think this debate has been hurt for a number of years, that it was presented as this kind of binary, that you know, you had these kind of early internet evangelists and especially Silicon Valley, to Silicon Valley's own benefit, you know, really push this idea that, you know, that the internet is a realm apart and it shouldn't be regulated, and, you know, we have absolute free speech and information will set us free. And you know, I don't think there's any country in the world where that's actually true. Everyone regulates content online, and everyone, you know, has laws that govern these issues. And I think we're now dealing with, though, the fact that we haven't had this debate, that we, you know, a lot of democratic societies have kind of let the situation get so far out of control that we're trying to rein it in all in one go and pass all this regulation across a host of different issues. You know, we frame these things together, like fake news and extremist content and various other issues. We frame them all together, but really they should be tackled one by one. These are different, you know, they're related, but they're not, you know, you can't legislate them all at once, and we're trying to do that. And I think that is partly because for so long there was, you know, there was this kind of flawed binary debate.
Yeah, Quentin.
In this democracy where hopefully the rule of law will prevail, taking up your point, Mark Zuckerberg has invited regulation after the Christchurch atrocity, and there are many other things that Facebook has unwittingly, we hope, facilitated, like the destruction of the human rights of the Rohingya in Myanmar. So Facebook's got a lot to answer for, and Zuckerberg has preemptively come forward to say, yes, we should have some regulation. Where's this going to lead? Because ultimately, in those countries which have independent judiciaries and a rule of law, we're going to have to get case law established on the what is free speech and what is allowable, and new definitions of hopefully progressive, enlightened exchange within a democracy. Mm. Is this where we're going?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, the really important word in your question was preemptively. You know, Facebook is very, very keen to get ahead of this, and I think that will, you know, massively influence the type of regulation that they're eventually subjected to. In terms of crafting this in a way that benefits users and you know, kind of protects free speech while dealing with a lot of the problems, the concerning thing for me, I think about, especially about the recent Australian social media law, is that it puts a lot of the onus on these private companies to self-regulate or face the consequences, which is actually a very Chinese model in a way. And the difficulty there is that, you know, if it's a private company, then we're not going to have things like judicial review to contest these issues. It's not necessarily going to be very transparent how they do this. It's already not transparent. You know, the kind of terms and services of Facebook already kind of applied very randomly and tend to be applied in line with how much media attention X issue is getting. And this is kind of goes to my point about this is, you know, this is legislation that is going to be very difficult to craft and should be crafted slowly and, you know, with you know, a lot of thought and with the cooperation of these companies, but also not farmed out to these companies. I don't think we should necessarily trust Facebook to self-regulate. You know, they're making a lot of noise about this at the moment, but they're doing that, like you said, preemptively to avoid something that they don't want the governments to write this. They want to write this legislation. And we should be suspicious of that, just as we should be suspicious of, you know, government overreach as well.
Hey, thanks for your presentation. My name's Ben. I work in the tech sector. A few years ago, a developer published some technology on an open source repository called GitHub, which allowed Chinese citizens to get past anti-censorship methods that China used. Some researchers looked into it and found that China's response was to flood this website, essentially creating a denial-of-service attack to take down the website in protest, essentially. And they found that essentially China managed to weaponize their population to conduct an attack on this publicly owned entity. What's the panel's views on the ability for not just Chinese censorship, but the ability to weaponize a population against anti-censorship technology?
Sort of vigilantes, you mean, like nationalist vigilantes helping out?
The researchers found that it was actually the Chinese government that managed to weaponize their own population to take down this anti-censorship technology. It was coined the Great Cannon of China. Mm. I think it's good imagery with the Great Firewall.
Good branding, yeah.
I think that's, you know, is absolutely the case. It's well documented. As you say, there's, you know, they call them they used to call them the Wu Mao Dang, these people who got paid allegedly, you know, the equivalent of 50 cents for every kind of post that they put up that was nationalistic or pro-government in some way. And you can see, I mean, the numbers say that there are literally millions of people employed by the system to do a little bit of censorship on the side or a little bit of this kind of, you know, posting for profit. I would say that how necessary is this going to be in the future when you've got AI and you've got bots and you can flood the system doing that? So, I mean, it's absolutely something that the system's been able to do in the past to great effect, including for those kinds of denial of service attacks. But I don't know that it will matter that much in future. But you might have a different view.
I was just going to raise as well that, you know, we talk about Wumadang, which happens inside China, but also there's been these recently and kind of there's increasingly been kind of what are called expeditions overseas that the kind of Taiwanese government was targeted on Facebook and stuff. And I recently reported on a bunch of Uyghur Facebook communities which kind of share news about the situation in Xinjiang, and they were absolutely flooded. But via a kind of nationalist Chinese forum called Diba, they were flooded in this organized kind of trolling attack. And, you know, it didn't really affect their ability to react. It's not like a denial of service at their pages on Facebook and stuff. But it's about kind of harassment, and it's about kind of, you know, threatening and making this an unpleasant sphere to operate in. And, you know, that's a really kind of interesting way of kind of weaponizing an internet population. But importantly as well, I think, you know, while the government kind of state media cheerleaded these attacks, there isn't that much evidence that they necessarily directed it, because when you have a very kind of nationalist sentiment online and you control the conversation so that this is the only kind of interpretation of this issue you can have, it's quite easy to get people to go and be horrible to a bunch of Uyghur Facebook groups on the other side of this issue.
And I mean, the weaponization, I mean, I doubt that it starts online. It basically, I think it starts, you know, very early from, you know, the education when you go to primary school, and in your history textbook, it tells students that, you know, we have been invaded and our, you know, our great national pride has been taken away. And this is China's time to rise. And, you know, what happens when Taiwan challenges us? What happens when, you know, the Uyghur separatists or the Tibetan separatists, what happens when they challenge us? You know, we should show them that we're this great nation. And when you sort of teach your students, teach your children to think this way, you don't need to hire Wu Mao, you know, because you have a whole generation of young people who grew up without Google, without Facebook. We have our own sort of Chinese internet system, and we have our own sort of value system. And when you expose these young people, like basically people from my generation, when you take them overseas, when they're exposed to a completely different set of information, when they hear about 1989 for the first time, they feel personally attacked, a lot of them, myself included. And that's when they're gonna, you know, they're gonna argue with you, like, I don't think 1989 happened. Well, that was the first time when I heard of 1989 in Australia. I was like, did that actually happen? Because, you know, growing up in China, I had never heard of this event. If I'm Chinese and I grew up there and I never heard of it, did it happen? Mm. So that's when you turn your young people into voluntary, when you weaponize them, but, you know, in a way that is completely, you know, it's not like a top-down sort of, you know, policy that we're going to weaponize these people, but this thing kind of just happens slowly and happens within your sort of education system.
Yeah, interesting. All right, look, this will have to be the last question.
Hi, James, there was something that you said that just kind of struck me when you talked about how the technology is really quick to catch up. And it just sort of reminded me of, you know, when Donald Trump was talking about banning Huawei and he wanted an American tech company to install 5G, and alas, he has none. And I'm just kind of, my question is, you know, is that something that's, you know, are we looking at a China that is technologically superior now, you know, when it comes to the investment that it has made into, how sophisticated this technology is, that it is able to evolve and anticipate and prevent, but also on the other side, expanding and exporting and you know, selling technology to the rest of the world. What does this say about the Chinese sort of investment in the technology in the sector versus, you know, the States, which, you know, Silicon Valley and all the rest of it? While we're all here quibbling about privacy concerns, what's China doing at the same time?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I don't think we would be having the same debate about Huawei if there was a US competitor that's prepared to, you know, roll out stuff for the same price and can do it the same day. You know, I think Washington would just be kind of quietly having a word with its allies and saying, we prefer you to use this one than Huawei rather than taking this public. But, you know, yeah, China is definitely leading the way in certain key areas. Infrastructure, internet infrastructure is the main obvious one, but also this surveillance tech. Investing in AI is a huge investment in China. And this is, you know, benefits the Chinese state, which is why it's been so encouraged. And then also has a clear kind of market overseas that you're able to go to various countries around the world and say, we'll sell you these incredibly sophisticated surveillance tools and we'll sell you these great AI tools, which will, you know, not only help you control your population, but potentially can, you know, benefit economic growth and things like that. And, you know, I think it's a very persuasive argument in a lot of the world and, you know, perhaps even beyond, you know, beyond the parts of the world that we might think it's persuasive in, and as we've seen with how attractive Huawei is for, you know, well beyond, you know, I think Australia's taken a pretty hard line, but, you know, there's several Five Eyes nations who are kind of pretty uncertain because actually they would quite like to have this tech and, you know, they don't really want to pay the prices that Ericsson wants and they're not really capable of providing it anyway. And so it's, yeah, it's a very awkward situation that we're in.
All right. Well, look, thank you for your questions and thanks to our panelists. Really fascinating discussion. Thanks for joining us tonight.